Welcome back, folks. This is Archaic Wrestling. We are, as always, Evan and Sasha, happy to be bringing to you all the fun and interesting aspects of wrestling history. And hopefully we don't have too many listeners for this podcast, Sasha, who might be... hopefully we have plenty of listeners, but let's hope that not too many of them are on a low-sodium diet because they are going to have to swallow quite the large grain of salt with some of this information we'll be giving out today. We're going to be covering Senegalese wrestling, or LOM, as it's known more locally in Senegal. And unfortunately, a lot of the information out there is not in English. A lot of it's in French. And we'll talk a little bit more about how it went trying to research this topic. But before we get into that, maybe a little update. Last time we spoke, we were complaining a little bit about the Pacific Athletic Conference and its slow demise. But since then, we were taking a look, and Stanford has left the Pac-10, or Pac-12, excuse me, Pac-whatever it's going to be, and has joined the ACC, which makes perfect sense, of course. And worse for Stanford wrestling, Rob Cole is leaving Stanford and heading to UNC. How do you feel about that, Sasha?
You know, it makes perfect sense. If you conceive of the Atlantic coast as running all the way down, down from South America, all the way through, very tip, all the way back up, past Chile, past Mexico, all the way back up to us, and then, you know, boom, that's the Pacific coast. So that's then if you conceive of the Atlantic coast in that sense, it makes perfect sense that Stanford would be
in the Atlantic
Coast Conference.
Yeah, you know, we just have to flip our perspective.
Yeah, it's only like 2,000 miles away from the closest school. It's fine. This is fine.
Makes perfect sense. No one's confused.
There is no problem with this. No athletes will have any trouble with the new travel requirements that are posed by this. It is great. It's great that they lost the coach that they just hired, who just went on FRL and bragged about how good his recruiting class was, that he was going to continue to get better and better recruiting classes, that he was just so good as a coach that they didn't think he could do it, and he was going to keep doing it, and he wasn't going anywhere because he was doing so well at Stanford. So it's cool that he just left. In general, I think it's going really well. Yeah.
Well, you know, Rob Cole, he's the money guy, you know, he's really good at raising the money. That's the part that he's really talented at. So he brings in the really good assistant coaches to run the program or the wrestling aspect of it. But unfortunately, the Bay Area was a little too expensive for Rob, and, you know, he had an opportunity to go to his alma mater. So, see you, Rob. It was a good 2 years.
I hope he enjoys new, probably couple more thousand square feet that he's going to get in his house. I hope he enjoys some of his new closets. It's good for you, Rob. Enjoy your new closets. Enjoy having a guest, maybe another couple guest bedrooms. It's great. I hope... I hope it was all worth it. I'm so glad that we got rid of Jason Borelli. Everything has been going so good here at Stanford Wrestling.
For the listeners who don't know, Rob Cole has left as the head coach, and he in his email to the whoever had signed up for the Stanford newsletter, let folks know that one of the reasons was because of the cost of living in the Bay Area, which is, you know, substantial for sure. I struggle to really take too seriously that reason.
It's living in Palo Alto.
Sure, you know, which is expensive, of course, but I think Rob might be making more than some of us. He doesn't have to live in Palo Alto, just like most folks do not who work there probably don't live there. But whatever, we'll get, you know what, I'm not sure where Cole is going to appear on our ironic enemies list I don't think he's quite S tier here.
I think he's number one. I think he might be number one.
He's probably the only one that's really on the list at the moment, but I wouldn't put him at S tier or A tier here, right? You know, I don't really hold some hard feelings for him here, but we are disappointed, Rob. You know, this hurts. You know, we had a lot of faith in you. We're really excited about it, but you know, I guess a man's got to do what he's got to do for his family.
Yeah, I'd like to. We're about to start a years long project of finding Rob Cole's tax returns, and boy, when you get them, you better believe we're gonna be showing them on here. And it's going to be very disappointing and uninteresting.
Well, I mean, it couldn't be any more or less uninteresting than some of our other conversations. So we'll see how it goes. But apart from that, I think at least for me, on a much more positive note, we have started to see, at least to some degree, we have very little data, but we have now seen some really good wrestlers competing under the new three-point rule, who's number one just happened. And we got to see a good 10, I think it was 10 different match, 10, it was all the boys' matches, competing with the three-point move. And Sasha, I know you didn't get a chance to watch it yet, but from my perspective, a lot of the things that people were worried about did not manifest in these matches. People weren't just trying to hold on to leads. There was, you know, people weren't afraid to shoot. They weren't weren't worried about giving up takedowns, you know, because of the extra point added to them now. It just looked like regular wrestling. People just scored more points. And in some matches, it was really cool because they cranked up, you know, up at both wrestlers getting up into the teens with points without it being just one of those JV matches where people are just rolling around too much and giving up back points back and forth. These were good competitive matches that were high scoring. And I didn't see any reason to be worried about what the three-point takedown is going to do. Now, keep in mind, this is who's number one. It's still high schoolers. It's not exactly a college competition where college coaches are going to be figuring out how they're going to respond to these things. So it's still early. There's still lots to watch and find out. But so far, so good, I felt. And yeah, anybody that disagrees should email us at archaicwrestling@gmail.com.
Yeah, I always found the idea that making the takedown worth more points was going to suddenly stop people from trying to achieve takedowns. I mean, it's like, well, if you get taken down, it's worse for you now. It's like, well, if you get the takedown, it's also good. Like, this is like the classic one where it's like, well, you know, it's a double-edged sword. It's like everything is a double-edged sword. It's a mm-hmm. sport. You try to win, the other guy tries to win. It's all, there's always going to be an element of defense and offense to it.
Yeah. But yeah, that was my perception so far. Looks just fine, looks good. And what I really liked seeing were, you know, the score of the match reflected what was happening in the match. I really appreciated that. The guy that got two takedowns and an escape and held the other guy down scored lots of points, and the other guy that got one escape was far behind them. And that's how it should look. That's what the takedown dominance should be. So I was happy with it. But once again, we will not know until we get a lot more matches under our belts with this to really see what it looks like, see who's going to be able to take advantage of it or not take advantage or find the loopholes. So I'm excited to see that too. So today, leading in, as I said at the beginning of the pod, this was a tricky one to research. We're researching Senegalese wrestling, Senegal obviously being the most western point of Africa, and specifically we'll be talking about the city of Dakar, where a lot of the main cultural around the wrestling, professional aspect of this wrestling takes place. But, you know, it's not just Senegal that does it. Parts of Gambia do. A lot of different parts of Western Africa participate, but Senegal is the main one. And because it was so difficult to research, I made some attempts to get in touch with people from Senegal or anybody that might have a little bit more information on this. In fact, one of the citations that we that we will have in the description, I contacted the actual researchers, actually people that conducted the research. They're all the way in France, just trying my best to get in touch with them, and got no response, unfortunately, there. And I was really relegated to starting to reach out to Senegalese people more locally, because I wanted to speak with someone that had more firsthand experience with it, because I have to say, the rules are very hard to figure out, because different places on the internet are giving different rules, and we're watching the videos, and it's very obvious that some of the stuff that you're reading on the internet is not accurate, at least not stuff written in English. A lot of stuff that is in English on the internet is obviously like pushed through Google Translate from French. I don't speak French or read French, so anything that was in French, I couldn't recognize. So I started reaching out to local folks. I emailed and called local Senegalese restaurants in the Bay Area. I called a hair braiding location, and they were the only ones that actually got back to me. And I spoke to a very nice woman who, you know, was very interested in what we were doing and wanted to put us in touch with somebody that could speak with us about it a little bit more in detail. And she got me in touch with the president of the Senegalese Foundation of the East Bay. And that guy responded twice and then just ghosted me, unfortunately. So a big thank you to the women out there that do braiding from Senegal. You were very helpful, but a little disappointed in the rest of the community, because several of them were like, oh, my brother, my cousin would love to talk to you. Of course they did, and they did not want to talk to us. And so we will be doing our very best this episode with what information we have.
Yeah, it's too bad we couldn't get someone else, because I mean, I think, you know, you and me, we were watching this, we were going back and forth. I think we've pieced together among, you know, the two different styles, sans frappe and avec frappe. Is that, my French is not
I don't know.
Incredible. But I think we've pieced together most of the rules of these two styles. I think we have a fairly good understanding of, you know, how you win, how you lose. But the thing that was so interesting about this is all of the cultural pieces that like came into it. So almost sort of like the Mongolian wrestling, where really a lot of stuff happens in Senegalese wrestling before and after the match.
Yeah, and there's
a lot of cultural practices that go along with it.
Yeah, and you know, this is one of those situations where the location that this is taking place, the cultural origins, there wasn't written language for a long time. So a lot of the wrestling, that history here is not going to be something that we have evidence for, but it's pretty clear that this goes back a long, long time. In this area of the world, in what we now call Senegal, a lot of the wrestling was something where it would be to celebrate a harvest. It would be to like challenge somebody, to put on a display, to show your strength. For a lot for men, it was about impressing women, right? Trying to prepare for battle, right? Yeah, that's how it was integrated into culture. And it goes back at least to the 1300s is what the only thing I was really able to find. That's as far back as they can figure that it would have gone back. And they believe the furthest back origins they have are the Serer people, which is a ethnic minority that lives within Senegal. I believe they're the second largest ethnic group behind what's called Wolof. And in fact, the term Lam, which refers to Senegalese wrestling, that's what Lam means, is wrestling, is a Wolof word. So within all of this, you're going to see a lot of Wolof is being spoken quite a bit, but French is heavily spoken and heavily influenced over the terminology and the national bodies within Lam wrestling, because the French colonized Senegal for a very, very long time. And so that's why we see so much French, and it is like the main language in a lot of places around Senegal.
Yeah.
the sport now, I guess we should talk about what it looks like, right? The big thing that's going to stand out for people, and what a lot of people will actually maybe even argue that this might not actually be a form of wrestling, is the fact that you're allowed to punch people.
And yeah, so there's two styles.
Yeah.
Kind of like how I was referring to before, right? There's I mean, yeah, I'm gonna butcher it. I don't speak French, but it's like lutte traditionnelle sans frappe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's frappe. You guys can yell at me in the you guys can email and yell at me. I didn't look it up, right? And then an avec frappe. So that's, you know, without punching or with punching. And both of them, I will say, both of them look fairly similar. I don't think the punching doesn't change it into an entirely new style. It's sort of just like it just looks like it sucks a lot more to do, but is also fairly similar, and the ways you win can be fairly similar.
Yeah, and the lack of punching is what you would typically see more at like the local level, right? Where you have, you know, your village and you're practicing there, or it's, you know, it's once a year, everyone comes to wrestle. And in more modern times, this is where you'll see more women actually participating as well. The striking aspect is really what you see at the higher level, the level where people are able to make money from it, essentially. From what I understand, this came in around 1930, where they started doing the punching aspect. I found a video as far back as 1960 where they were punching each other, so it's at least that old. And the idea is you are allowed to punch people, but it still is very much wrestling, because the rules aren't about, like, if you knock someone out, you don't win because you knocked that person out. You win because that person hit the ground a certain way, right? Yeah. So if someone is knocked out, they go right to their back or hit their fall to their head or their butt or their hip, then they lose. So this is another one of those folk styles, which is starting to, you know, pretty much be almost all of them to some degree here, where the matches are pretty short, you know, they can be very fast or they can take a little while, usually not more than about 10 minutes or so. But if you fall your back to the ground, your butt to the ground, your hip or your head touches the ground, you lose. And that can happen by being knocked out, but more likely it's going to happen through a grappling exchange, right? And I think a lot of the techniques that we see are a lot of like blast double styles. I saw some hip throws. There's a lot of grabbing people. In fact, they're kind of wearing a loincloth is what people are wearing. And it's called the Taknagemb, I believe it's called. And so you're allowed to grab there. You'll see a lot of underhook stuff. You'll see a lot of locking in the crotch and lifting from there. And there's no weight class. Once again, another folk style with no weight class. So the folks doing it are very large, as you might expect. But that doesn't mean that there aren't smaller competitors. The thing with LOM is it's not the same as a lot of other wrestling styles where they do tournament formats, right? Where it's like a double elimination or, you know, you work through a bracket. LOM wrestling is treated much more like boxing or MMA in terms of how fighters are paired together. It's prize fighting for the most part, at least at the higher levels. So in Dakar, where pretty much all the big fights happen, they have a big 20,000 person capacity arena, Arena Nationale de Lutte. And it's where all the big matches happen. It's a very large circle, and they compete on sand. They also train on sand, as you might expect. So these guys are very big. Bodybuilding is a very big part of the culture, and a lot of like makeshift devices are used to bodybuild. They'll do the thing where they'll fill up paint cans with cement or sand and lift those, right? They create their own benches, and you know, you might see some of that on social media sometimes. Usually you'll see some guys, you can tell it's like an African country, and you know, they've created barbells out of just cement and rusty pieces of metal they have lying around, right? And the actual combat here, essentially, is a way for a lot of people to get out of poverty. It's like a professional sport in which people are seeking ways to no longer be in poverty, to get lots of attention, get lots of fame, and win these prize fights, right? So the people that tend to train LOM are, you know, they have side jobs, right? They're not just training LOM, even though they might technically be professional, because they're not going to make a ton of money unless they're one of like the top couple dozen fighters in Dakar.
Yeah, and it seems like some of the popularity coincided with economic downturn in Senegal. What we've seen is that like a lot of the popularity, like it did become a lot more popular with people after Senegal's economy started to go into like a major recession.
Yeah, I mean, you can make maybe around 80K per fight if you're one of the better wrestlers. You see a lot of wealth culture surrounding it, right? A lot of the wrestlers want to display their wealth. So a lot of like wearing gold chains and things like that to signal that they have overcome poverty. In fact, like one of the most famous or popular Senegalese wrestlers is a guy named Mohamed Nadal. And he took on the nickname of Tyson after Mike Tyson. He's one of the first wrestlers that, yeah, and he's gone and he trains in the USA. And he has this brand of being like a self-made man who came from nothing in poverty from Dakar. And now he trains in the United States and he flies back over for competitions and stuff, right? And that's really kind of the dream when you're talking about a LOM wrestler who is able to make it, right? To be able to be one of the people that can do this for a living, right?
Yeah, I feel like this is a good time to get into the BAC. So before, you know, each, like Evan said, right, this is it's more closer to prize fighting than like a tournament. And before each match, they'll show up sometimes even like an hour before their match. And they have like, it kind of reminds me, there's a lot of similarities between this and the Mongolian wrestling that we covered last week. And I think the differences here and the similarities are really interesting, both in the style and in the culture surrounding it. So they show up not with like, you know, just their one person, right? Their second, like you had in the Mongolian wrestling. They show up with, you know, an entire retinue. They have like a whole group of people with them. And before each of their matches, you know, each side has their own choreographed dance. And so each wrestler has not only their own choreographed dance, but like they put it together. It's a dance that they put together that is specific to them that only they do. So it'll have, you know, each people will do like similar moves or the same moves. But like I saw, you know, when I was watching some of these highlights, I saw them, you know, drive in a car and everyone hopped out, like drive onto the field in a van. Everyone jumps out and starts doing this dance. And then they also perform like a sort of a song or a poem before each match. And those poems themselves, right, those are also written by the wrestler, and they also become, at least it seems like in the culture, like almost as important as the wrestling, or like those words are imbued with a lot of meaning from like how good that wrestler is. So a lot of them will become like extremely popular. So Mike Tyson, right, I have up here some of like one of his. There's also another champion that we read about that I read about in the same paper from the 1980s who had not only like such a good performance that it became so popular they would like play it every Sunday before the like matches would start. They'd play it and like kids would act it out and they would say it. So it's kind of a really interesting thing that they add on to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of showmanship, a lot of like performance, and there's a lot of like spiritualism, right? Like I mentioned, they wear that loincloth, but you'll also see the wrestlers are often, they're like strapped up with lots of belts going around them and twine that's wrapped around them. And what these are is these are straps that are holding on special charms. And they're essentially lucky charms, right? Because each wrestler, as part of his retinue, right, his friends, his training partners, maybe a coach, one of the other people that's part of his retinue is a spiritual advisor or a guidance person. And they will constantly throughout the process of their training, their competition, they will be essentially blessing the wrestler or performing prayers on them. And the wrestler will wear those charms that have been given to them. And they'll also often douse themselves with potions or oils that have been prayed over or have been blessed themselves. And I had a hard time figuring out, like, what are the contents of some of these. The only one that I actually figured out of, like, what is the stuff they actually put on them was sometimes they pour sour milk on themselves, which was, you know, nice. That's interesting, I guess. Maybe it's a good way to recycle old milk. I don't know. But yeah, so there's a lot of spiritual aspect to it where they're coming in not just prepared in the sense of, you know, I'm mentally prepared, I'm physically prepared, but I've also, you know, got the magic on my side too. And it goes hand in hand with the performance aspect that you talked about, right? Yeah. It is just a very big show. It reminded me a lot of the tone of some WWE style wrestling, right? Like performance wrestling.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, with actual combat, right?
Something I found really interesting is I've also seen, you know, like prior to us even doing this podcast, I saw like a little video documentary about somewhere in West Africa where people are doing their own, you know, like professional, like showmanship wrestling that has a lot to do with, and it seems like such an obvious outgrowth of this type of culture of just keeping all of the showmanship, a lot of like things with like magic where they do, you know, they'll like perform spells in the ring and then that will, you know, win them the match, things like that. And it's actually kind of interesting that it's so much, you know, less popular than just the actual real wrestling is.
Yeah, it gets treated as kind of like a tailgating sideshow compared to like the actual event, right? And you'll just have this ring that's set up and everyone's surrounding it. And the community is very involved in this stuff. It's not just like your fans are there. Like at the smaller level, sometimes after a wrestler wins, you know, not only do they, you know, go back into do their dance and celebration, but the crowd will rush the pitch, for lack of a better term, right?
Yeah.
Not unlike, you know, you would see in other sports as well, but it seems to be like, no, there's always somebody rushing the pitch. There's always someone running to hug the wrestler or stand with him and carry each other around or something, right? There's always a lot of celebrating going on. It's very performative.
And so I have, I was able to pull up some of the speeches that they make, and I'll go through them. And I mean, I'm sure I can't really do it justice. I think we need to hear it like in the context with the music, their actual performance. Mm-hmm. And it was also really interesting because this comes from, so I don't know if you encountered this while you were researching this, but the concept of like a griot, or maybe that's griot. So that's like a storyteller, like someone who would tell stories. It's sort of like someone who maintains oral tradition in like a lot of like different parts of West Africa. It's from what I can tell and in this paper I'm reading. So the outgrowth of that is that the wrestlers themselves sort of became their own griots and they have their own story. So I think at some point that used to be maybe like their griot would tell this story or would do this speech and then they started taking it over. So like this, the most famous one that we were talking about, by Mame Gorgui Nindiaye. I'm doing my best here. The translation goes, "It is fair to say that I did it. No one dare say that I didn't. Anyone who is trained as I would have beaten the best ones. I traveled to Luga with Arachnar. I recognized that Sambaya Sambaye Sali Thiorye was a great wrestler. I also recognize Modu Kane, who is Papa Kane's father. I recognize such hard-to-find wrestlers. So there's a lot of, like, boasting in it, but it's also really interesting that I think we've seen this from pretty much every wrestling folk style we've seen. There always seems to be a tremendous amount of respect for each other than every single one of these folk styles that we've seen.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, like, reference to heritage, too, right? It's like,
yeah,
especially with the Senegalese wrestling, there was just a lot of, like, you know, my father wrestled, my older brother wrestled, his father wrestled, right? And that's you know, that's my line, that's my lineage, and there's a lot of local neighborhood pride, right? So, like, each, like I mentioned before, Dakar, the capital, is still, like, the biggest place for the wrestling. But each of the different neighborhoods in Dakar, a lot of them have their own, like, wrestling club, wrestling stable, where they train together. And, oh, so-and-so came out of the whatever neighborhood of Dakar, right? There's a lot of, like, neighborhood-level pride. Which makes sense because it has those origins in, you know, something very local, right? Talking about your local harvest, your and with it being, for a lot of folks, their focus of how this is how I'm getting out of poverty, you know, I'm gonna be that you know, big giant dude, right? And yeah, and so speaking a little bit more, like, we mentioned that, you know, they're big, they're giant, and they're really just as big as any of these other wrestlers that we've seen. They're really big, they're really huge. I think when it comes to some of these higher level guys, I'm not super confident in the amount of drug testing and regulation that's involved in this sport. So
yeah.
there's definitely guys on some stuff for sure. But they are huge. They are huge and big. And it really seems like their go-to way that they want to put someone down, what, you know, some guys, they do seem a little bit more into the punching aspect. But if they're not knocking someone out, they're getting into a clinch. And from the clinch, you'll see a lot of uppercuts to the body. See a lot of that, still looking to punch someone in the hips. But people really like to lift in this sport, right?
Yes.
They want to lift people up and put them back down pretty hard. You don't see a lot of suplex style stuff because I think guys are really trying to avoid allowing their back to face the mat at all, or excuse me, face the sand or the ground at all. And you'll notice a lot of that. Guys don't want to get too low because they don't want to get sprawled on. Because another way in which you can lose, other than your butt, your head, your back, your hip touching the mat, is as long as you're the defensive wrestler, if you go down and both hands and both knees are on the ground, or we're not sure if it's elbows or hands, I think it's at least hands. But if you have essentially 4 points of contact down, then you lose. At least if you have two knees down. So you'll see guys, they'll be down in essentially a referee's position, but they'll keep one knee up. And as soon as that knee touches, they lose. But, you know, unfortunately, often they're there, they keep one leg up, and they're just eating punches from the guy on top. Just punch,
yeah.
punch, right to their face. And this is bare knuckle, of course. It doesn't look like they're, you know, going easy on the punches either. But as long as they can tough it out and get back up, they can keep wrestling from there. You know, you're not seeing, you might see, I actually didn't see a lot of folk style stand-ups. Like, you'd see guys standing up, but there's a lot of reaching back, and they're more looking for a hip toss than they are to just break grip and face, it seems like, right? They're always
yeah.
looking for the way that they're going to put someone down from there.
Yeah, so I watched a video of, like, a bunch of different matches, and I also watched, there's like, for, you know, how rare we would think this is, there's at least one account on YouTube that is putting together, like, 40-minute videos of, like, Senegalese wrestling matches.
Is that the,
It's Ellie...
Yeah,
it?
Ellie Boy
Ellie
or
Boy.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah,
the only,
Ellie
yeah,
Boy
the only one putting anything out there. Yeah.
And he puts together a lot of stuff. It's awesome. So I watched one video that was top 15 moves in Senegalese wrestling. They all had, like, their own names. So I kind of got a good idea of, like, a lot of different things they do in different positions. So, you know, a lot of it is very similar to the Mongolian wrestling. There's like a ton of underhook and knee picks, overhook knee picks, like things of that nature where they're just like blasting through someone. They use the loincloth a lot. So there will be a lot of times where they'll say, like, you know, they'll have an overhook on one side, they'll grab the loincloth, and then they'll grab a knee and they'll drive to that overhook side. So there's a lot of things like that, that are just like very upper body. There's a ton of judo throws, especially when you come into the loincloth. There's a ton of throws where they're like, I saw one where someone came in, shot textbook high C, came around the back, and then got lat whipped.
Yes, incredible. That was there's actually quite a few on some of those highlights I saw where I saw some stuff that I wasn't expecting to see, like some back trip stuff, like from below. Yeah, a lot of that judo hip toss stuff they looked really good at. And you mentioned the high C. I feel like we hadn't seen a lot of high C style entries in a lot of these folk styles. But this one, there was definitely more of it. Definitely a little bit more trying to come underneath, get your shoulders underneath someone, hips underneath them, right?
Was an enormous amount of high C shots, but the vast, like 99% of them were accompanied by a fireman's carry.
Yeah,
it looks like almost all the time they're shooting down there, they're hitting like these incredible firemans, whether they pick them all the way up and throw them, or they do like a more traditional shoot and then, you know, kind of fall to their side and do it. So a lot of the stuff they're going for seems to be like, even when they're using more of like our, you know, American folk style sort of entries, they're usually going for like higher amplitude moves. Like, one thing I thought was interesting, every entrance I saw to a snatch single, right, to like an upright snatch single, always ended in, you know, coming in, getting the snatch single, getting the loincloth, and then going to a lift every single time.
Yeah. And because they just need someone to hit both, like 4 points, essentially both knees, both hands, and doesn't have to go to like a hip or back, they're very, very willing to just pick someone up and it's more of like a redrop, right? Like they're just putting it back down rather than a real like amplitude throw. Although they had some of those, there were some sick like arm throws too. Just straight.
Oh yeah, that was a really good one in there.
Like not even arm spin, just like straight over the top arm throw, that style, right? These guys are really strong for sure. There's not a lot of highlights of lesser weights, I guess, like lower weights. Everyone is still pretty big, but I did see a few where it was some smaller guys, you know, proportionally, I guess, like in relatively. A lot more getting under folks. I saw a little bit more of being willing to hit one knee on a shot. I think they're really avoiding hitting both knees because they don't want to get caught underneath somebody. And a little bit of back arch stuff going on. There's a lot of not just strength involved in this, even though the guys are so big. They're doing some flexibility stuff. They're getting into some awkward positions and scoring off of it. Really, really nice looking wrestling. And looked a little bit different, I think, than the Mongolian wrestling. I think with just a couple rule tweaks, this would look a lot more like the Turkish oil wrestling.
Once they get to like parterre, like a referee's position, I saw at least one instance pushing a knee down in the sand, looking at the ref and going like, hey, like what the fuck, what's going on? And sort of, so it seems like a bit of a gray area as to like, it seems like, I don't know, as long as you're working towards something, it seems like they want it to be more definitive. So, some of the stuff I saw from the like the Turkish wrestling, I feel like we saw a lot of freestyle type parterre, like a lot of like crotch locks, and trying to like roll someone over their back, exposure type stuff. A lot of the sort of, you know, better, lack of a better term, mat wrestling that I saw in the Senegalese wrestling was, okay, you got someone's back, they have both knees in the sand, both hands, they're surviving. I saw one where a guy's just trying to get a shoulder into the sand. he just pushed him over to where the one guy's just shoulder hit, and then that was enough. Or I see a lot of times they actually pick them up, and they basically just do a mat return.
Yeah, they just lift them back up again.
And the mat return basically counts as a win, probably because, you know, it's a little bit more surface area of your body hits the sand when you're on that. But yeah, you can mat return someone straight down where they land both hands, both knees, and that'll be pretty much, in every case I saw, you know, that's a win too.
Yeah,
it's very high amplitude.
Yes, it is. And I think there's just also, because we're watching it and we can't understand what the announcer's saying or what, right? And the referee is definitely low. Like, the referee is definitely watching those knees. Like, you can tell.
Yeah.
And I think they just probably miss things sometimes, because there's definitely been moments where it's like a split second, right?
Yeah.
And I wonder if they have a concept of reaction time, possibly.
Right? I think they do. I think they must, because I saw a lot of instances when I was looking at this where, you know, it'd be like takedown or say like front headlock position.
Mm-hmm.
I did see a little bit of front headlock position. It doesn't seem like they use it a lot, but every time they do the front headlock, they're pretty much always looking for – they're basically always looking for a head in the hole finish.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not trying to get around. They're just trying to get like the opposite – drive in and get the opposite hip in the sand.
Yeah, I noticed they allowed them to do quick switches too. Like, you could – if you put one down, one up, it was okay. So hard to say, you know, it could be the referee. It could be the particular style that they're doing, or, you know, there's a lot we just unfortunately could not find out. And that was a little bit frustrating and left me feeling a little bit more thankful for some of the other information we had on the other styles. Or also just, I think there's a little bit of complication to this style with, like, is it one knee, two knee? Like, what's going on here? That we just didn't see with the others, right? It's a little less simple. And getting a little bit more towards like the folk style, freestyle territory, right? Where things, maybe because of how much money is involved here and like how they're really trying to create like a competitive atmosphere, those gray areas start to crop up a little bit. I don't know, right? But maybe that's why. I don't know.
It definitely seems, I think, of every folk style like we've gone over, I feel like this one has the most possibility. I feel like there's a lot of ways to win in this. I feel like, I think, you know, their main style, the way they want to win, is kind of closer. Most of their competitors want to win, I think, in a way that's closer to like the Mongolian Boke, where they're trying to get knee picks, judo throws, upper body, and like high amplitude stuff. And a lot of lifts, and they're trying to win with that. But it does seem like there is definitely room for competitors who want to win more on like a leg attack.
Yeah.
A little bit more of like a leg attack style. Like, I think this is one where I don't know, it'd be interesting. If like one of us was in there trying to I feel like if I really had to, I could figure out a way to transition some of the like things that I know from folk style wrestling to like do this one and try to do a decent job with like some of my leg attacks. Whereas I feel like if I ever did Mongolian Boke, you know, I'm not an upper body guy. I'd be rolled every time.
Yeah, like this one definitely, at least from our perspective, seems to leave the door open a little bit more for lower level attacks, because, you know, it's okay if my leg touches the ground, right? I'd be, like, is an ankle pick viable? Is a low single or sweep single viable, right? That kind of stuff is...
I think it is. I think a low single would be really viable, actually.
It is hard to say. I'm not certain, but it's possible. I would be very curious to see someone, like you said, someone with more of our background, jump into this and just try stuff. And see their reaction to it or how they would deal with it.
I don't know if you watched the same video. I watched like a little bit of it because it wasn't super useful. But there's, you know, like a classic Vice video, you know, where they get like just the most pasty nerd you've ever seen and like put him in a situation where he's like wearing the loincloth and trying to like do the Senegalese wrestling, and they had him do it with like children. But I think, I don't know, it'd be fun. This is definitely one. I think this is my favorite one that we've covered so far.
This is
one where, like, I'm sad that it doesn't have, like next year, I think we'll be able to watch the Mongolian wrestling. Like, we're going to be at that. We're going to figure it out. We're going to get a stream. We're going to watch that shit. But this one, I'm like, oh my God. Like, yeah. Like, is there how I'm going to try to look more into how we can watch this, because this to me, I think, like, with the combination of like the entrances, you know, the like cultural, musical, and like poetic aspects of it, and then just the actual wrestling, I found to be the most entertaining of any of the other ones so far.
Yeah, I actually totally agree. It's definitely my favorite so far too. I'll watch the heck out of Mongolian wrestling, but this one was really, really nice. It was very exciting, and because, like we said, there seems to allow a little bit more intricacies, it was more interesting to watch, I would say. I was more curious about what someone was going to do next with this one.
Exactly.
A little bit more variety. But yeah, it was really cool. And then just like as a quick side note, like I mentioned a little bit that at some of the local stuff, more women will be involved. I did want to mention, like, there doesn't seem to be a women's league at this higher level at all, where they're, you know, paying people out quite a bit. I guess there was an attempt back in 2013 to get one going, and that was attempted by a wrestler. Her name, like, kind of led the charge on it. Her name's Isabel Sambo, and she actually was an Olympian in freestyle wrestling. So she's one of the very few that I found who was making the transition from more of this traditional style into freestyle wrestling. And obviously she's not the only one, but I would say she's certainly the most prominent. She was actually the flag bearer for Senegal in Rio in 2016.
Yeah, I think people have like mentioned it earlier too, at like more recent world competitions, that like Senegal has had a fairly good women's team, or like we've been seeing them more often.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, and then on the like men's side of things, the only transition that really stood out to me was this Senegalese wrestling or LOM, it actually looks like a pretty good transition point to MMA. And I did see at least one or two Senegalese wrestlers who had transitioned, and big, giant, strong dude threw big punches. Like they don't throw like little like test jabs. Like they throw hard, but throwing big punches, has good takedown defense, and, you know, will just, and mostly just ragdolls people around the ring. So
yeah,
they would,
yeah,
you know, like this guy was just picking dudes up, slamming them. They stand up. Okay, I'm going to redrop them real hard. While they're down there, I'm going to throw, you know, punches just like I would do in my regular Senegalese wrestling, you know, got their back, throwing punches from there, you know, get into guard. I'm big and strong. I'm still just going to throw punches, right? And this particular fighter just didn't care anything about submissions or anything like that. It was just, I'm going to punch you, and I'm going to slam you, and I'm going to be heavy on top of you. Which is, you know, not a bad strategy in MMA. And that's why I was like, oh yeah, this totally makes sense as a transition point.
Yeah. These guys are like really, a lot of them are like really high level. it's really impressive stuff. Like the sort of a lot of moves that you're like very recognizable, not just doing like crazy, new things that only work in this folk style. No, I'd love to see, oh my God. I have like this vision in my head of like that old Deadliest Warrior like mm-hmm. History Channel, but we just get like different folk style competitors from around the world to compete
together
in each other's styles against each other. I really want to see one of these Senegalese wrestlers versus one of the Mongolian wrestlers in a Mongolian style and a Senegalese style. I think it would be so sick.
Yeah, I mean, especially like those two that you just said, like because we see so much similarities with those, because they're both so big, they have similar like outfits, you know, similar rules where you're allowed to grab stuff, right? I would be very interested to watch that. We are also just getting to see a lot of athletes that don't get a lot of attention in general, so or that we just don't get to see very much of, and you can really forget just how skilled people can be just within these other folk styles. Yeah, it was really cool researching this one. But once again, man, I just wish we could have got someone on here or at least talked with them beforehand who had a little bit more firsthand knowledge, because I feel like I still have so many questions about some of the details and a little bit more of the perspectives from the wrestlers themselves. I'm going to put a link in the chat to a paper where they did a lot of interviews of wrestlers, and it was a little bit more about, what wrestling means to them personally and like what it means for them to like overcome poverty and things like that. But it's also, it's got some quotes from the actual wrestlers themselves that I thought were really interesting. But I really wanted more of that. I wanted to speak with someone who just has a little bit more firsthand experience, get a little bit more about what it means to the community, because it is the national sport now. Like, it wasn't always, but it has grown to be the most popular sport there. And yeah, like the woman I got to speak with briefly was just like, yes, everyone loves LOM in Senegal. Everyone.
That's so sick.
Which is, and so every sick. Time I hear this, like, Mongolia is all about it, you know, like every time I hear that, I'm a little jealous, you know. Sumo's,
yeah, it's hard not
way,
to be,
you know.
It's hard not to be.
Yeah, it's got to be so cool to be in a place where the sport that you love is the most popular and important to your friends and family and community. You know, as a wrestler in the United States, you know, you can have that in some ways, but you're always kind of going like, oh yeah, you know, I sometimes don't talk about wrestling with new people because I don't want to, you know, get into the conversation, right?
Yeah.
But it's nice when you meet someone that knows about wrestling and you get to talk about it with them and not have to worry about, okay, well, I got to explain this, this, and this if I'm even going to have this conversation, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of these folks don't have to deal with that. But yeah, I really wanted to learn more about, like, who's the national body of this? Like, who puts on these fights? Where does this money come from? And just learn a little bit more that way. But, you know, it is what it is for now. Maybe we'll have to do another episode.
Yeah, we might have to do that. Might have to Google Translate and start messaging Ellie Boy, ask him where he gets all these clips, how we can watch it. You know, I mean, the comments on, there's tons of comments on these videos, right? But they're all in French.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll have to dive in here deeper, and if we can figure out links where people can watch this, we'll put it up, because that's part of what we're trying. We want to hopefully, we want to get a thing going where, you know,
grow the sport
where you guys can see, we're like, oh hey, there's gonna be Turkish wrestling tournament, here's where you're gonna watch it and what time, and we can all go over it. That would be a kind of a great thing if we could get that going with this podcast.
Yeah, and then we can put down betting.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think that's about it on this one, unless you got anything else to add.
Oh, no, that's it. Yeah, go watch it. It's really fun.
All right, sounds good. Folks, we'll have a really fun episode coming up next time. But until then, uh-oh, Sasha knows too much. But hey, until then, folks, have a good one.